Hello, and welcome to the July IASB Update Podcast. My name is Neely Shaw, and I'm the Executive Technical Director at the IASB. As has been the case for the last few months, I'm joined by Andreas Barco, Chair of the IASB. Andreas, welcome.
Thanks, Neely. Hi.
Now, July, I think you would say, Andreas, was quite an exciting month for us here at the IFRS Foundation. In addition to our monthly IASB meetings, our sister board, the International Sustainability Standards Board, held its inaugural meeting in Frankfurt in July. And I'll say a few more words about that later in this podcast. But first, let's start with some highlights with our July IASB meeting. And starting off the updates, we'll go into the post-implementation review of IFRS 9. Many of you may recall that the IASB decided to split the post-implementation review of IFRS 9 into three parts, consistent with how the standard was issued. The first part is the PIR on the classification and measurement requirements of IFRS 9, with the IASB discussing two more topics that came from the feedback it received on its request for information. So the first topic relates to modifications of financial assets and financial liabilities. And let's give a little bit more background on the issue. When a financial instrument is substantially modified, the whole old financial instrument is derecognized and a new financial instrument is recognized. One of the more common issues in practice is determining whether a modification is substantial. Respondents to our request for information tended to focus more on financial assets, as they stated that the requirements to address the issue are clearer for financial liabilities than for financial assets. So the IASB explored the possibility of starting a standard-setting project on amortized cost measurement to clarify what constitutes a modification of financial instruments, when a modification leads to derecognition, including in cases of financial assets, the interaction of or the boundary between a substantial modification and expiry to the rights of cash flows, the sequence or hierarchy of modifications and expiry to the rights of cash flows, and the treatment of fees and costs as a result of modifying the original contract. Secondly, the IASB discussed the application of the effective interest method. From our request for information, we heard that most respondents agreed that amortized cost measurement using the effective interest method provides useful information about the timing, amount, and uncertainty of future cash flows. To apply the effective interest method, entities are required to calculate the effective interest rate that exactly discounts the estimated future cash payments or receipts through the expected life of the financial asset or financial liability. However, most respondents said that the determination of the effective interest rate is an area that gives rise to many questions in practice and for which the IASB could make helpful clarifications and provide additional application guidance. Based on analysis of the feedback and the prioritization of the feedback, the IASB decided to add a project to its research pipeline to clarify the requirements in IFRS 9 for modifications of financial assets and liabilities and applying the effective interest method. So that's one part of the post-implementation review of IFRS 9. Continuing on with one of the projects that has emerged from this PIR of IFRS 9 and the classification and measurement requirements, Andreas, would you like to chat a little bit further about contractual cash flow characteristics?
Absolutely. And in contrast to the topics that you just discussed, Neely, this is a bit more advanced because it is already on our standard setting agenda. So in May of this year, the IASB decided to start a project to clarify particular aspects of the IFRS 9 requirements for assessing a financial asset's contractual cash flow characteristics. This month, the IASB discussed some of the principles behind the requirements for assessing whether the cash flows of a financial asset represent solely payments of principal and interest, or SPPI in short. The IASB first discussed the rationale behind some of the general requirements. Consideration discussed include the following, like amortized cost is not a suitable measurement technique for instruments with variability unrelated to a basic lending type return. In assessing whether an instrument is consistent with a basic lending arrangement, it is necessary to consider what the lender is being compensated for, regardless of whether a contractual term is common in the market. So it's the what and not the how. A contractual term that changes the timing or amount of contractual cash flows may be compatible with a basic lending arrangement if the contingent event is specific to the borrower and the cash flows both before and after the contingent event are solely payments of principal and interest. The IASB also discussed the characteristics of financial assets with non-recourse features and contractually linked instruments with the aim of clarifying the scope of the instruments to which specific requirements in IFRS 9 applies. We were not asked to make any decisions and will continue to discuss these topics, including examples of applying the requirements and in the case of financial assets with non-recourse features and contractually linked instruments, the need to assess the characteristics of the underlying asset or pool of assets. So that's in a nutshell nearly what we've discussed around contractual cash flow characteristics.
Thank you, Andreas. So continuing on with IFRS 9, as I had mentioned earlier, the IASB had decided to split the post-implementation review of IFRS 9 into three parts consistent with how the standard was issued. The second part of the PIR is on the impairment requirements in IFRS 9. In July, the IASB kicked off the impairment requirements project with a plan to begin outreach in September to work towards publication of a request for information in the first half of next year. In addition, the plan is for the staff to bring a paper to the IASB, likely in September, to discuss the last part of IFRS 9 and the question of when to possibly start the post-implementation review on the hedging requirements in IFRS 9. So, moving on to the next topic of discussion at the July board meeting, dynamic risk management. You all might remember in the IASB's last meeting, the dynamic risk management project was moved onto the standard setting program. In the July meeting, the IASB heard a project plan for assessing the dynamic risk management model. These are grouped based on the different elements of the DRM model and include eligible items and the determination of the current net open risk position, performance assessment and subsequent unwinding of the DRM adjustment, the target profile and its alignment with a company's risk management strategy, the risk mitigation intention and the construction of the benchmark derivatives, designated derivatives, and other considerations, including presentation and disclosure requirements. After the IASB discusses these topics, the board will issue an exposure draft.
So, Lily, if I can jump in here, I think the board was in broad agreement with the staff's project plan, but I think it's worthwhile flagging to our listeners that some of the board members raised quite some good points to just add on to the list that you have just given us. So, for instance, would we extend the model to other industries? And we have been made aware of the utility sector being interested, the insurance sector being interested. And I think there was a joint understanding that probably we would keep it confined to the banking business as a start and see whether we can make the model work before we actually extend it to any other industries. Another question concerned the relationship between the DRM model under development and the existing hedge accounting requirements per IFRS 9. How the two interrelate? Can you do both? Can you do one or the other? How close should the reflection of risk management practices go in the financial statements? And how many exceptions would we be prepared to make? There is an objective that DRM should reflect risk management practices of an entity, but we've already been made aware of that what's being done in practice may be quite some way apart from how we account for events and transactions. So we will have to consider whether we would be ready to make exceptions in that regard. And last but not least, a question that I particularly bring up whenever we discuss DRM is, would we think that the final model be mandatory or still voluntary, so more akin to hedge accounting or more mandatory just as any other requirement. So a lot of issues still to be discussed, but I think we have made good progress, so stay tuned.
And I think in light of your comments, Andreas, it explains why when I said that the IASB will be issuing an exposure draft, I didn't actually say when. There is definitely a lot to cover still. Should we move on to financial instruments with characteristics of equity? Would you like to provide some highlights from that part of the meeting?
With pleasure. So we are shifting standards, but still remain a financial instruments. At this meeting, the IASB started its discussions on accounting for financial instruments containing obligations to redeem own equity instruments. For example, written puts on non-controlling interest, or NCI puts in short. Companies often use these NCI puts to provide non-controlling interest holders with liquidity and the right to sell their shares to the majority shareholder in the future. Some practice issues have arisen from applying paragraph 23 of IAS 32, which discusses the accounting for a contract containing an obligation for a company to purchase its own equity instruments for cash or another financial asset. The practice issues the IASB discussed include the following four subjects. First, determining the debit entry on initial recognition. There is diversity in practice whether the NCI or equity belonging to the parent should be debited in the consolidated financial statements. IAS 32 could potentially be amended to clarify that on initial recognition of the NCI put liability, the debit entry is recognized against parent equity. This is because the NCI shareholders retain their rights and obligations until the put option is exercised. The accounting on initial recognition will affect the accounting for dividends subsequently paid to NCI shareholders and the accounting on expiry and settlement of the NCI put. Second issue concerns changes in the carrying amount of the financial liability and subsequent measurement of the NCI put. So here, there is a perceived conflict between the financial instrument accounting requirements and IAS 32, which refer to IFRS 9 for subsequent measurement of the financial liability, and the requirements in IFRS 10, which refer to equity transactions with owners in their capacity as owners. If IAS 32 is clarified that the debit entry on initial recognition goes against parent equity, we think it will be clearer that recognizing the financial liability for the put option does not change the respective ownership interests of the parent and the ICA shareholder at initial recognition or subsequently. Therefore, the subsequent measurement requirements need not be changed. The third issue we discussed referred to settlement in a variable number of shares. Questions arise when a company settles an NCI put with a variable number of parent shares instead of cash. IAS 32 could be clarified so that paragraph 23 applies also to an obligation to redeem own equity instruments that is settled in a variable number of another type of own shares. This is because using a variable number of own shares as currency in settlement is consistent with the definition of a financial liability and other requirements in IAS 32. And lastly, we discussed gross versus net presentation, which constitutes the fourth issue. Some stakeholders question whether to account for physically settled forward purchase contracts and written put options on a gross or net basis. Not much feedback was received on this topic from respondents to the 2018 discussion paper on FIAS, and reconsidering gross versus net presentation would be outside the scope of the current FIAS project. However, it would be useful to clarify the underlying rationale for gross presentation so that stakeholders can understand it better. At a future meeting, the IASB will make tentative decisions on clarifications to IAS 32, which would help resolve these practice questions.
Thanks, Andreas. So maybe why don't we move away from financial instruments and cover some of the other topics that we discussed in July. I'll start off next with primary financial statements, which is a topic that has been coming to the IASB pretty much every month now. In July, the IASB covered three topics. First, it continued developing its model to provide structure and comparability on the statement of profit or loss through the use of defined subtotals that, in effect, result in an operating, investing, and financing section on the statement of profit or loss. Now, many of you might recall that the IASB has developed a general model for most businesses, as well as some variations for companies with specified main business activities. So that is companies whose main business activity is to invest or provide financing to customers. In July, the IASB decided to confirm that companies who invest as a main business activity classify in the operating category income and expenses from assets that would otherwise be classified in the investing category. When these companies invest in financial assets as a main business activity, they also classify income and expenses from cash and cash equivalents in the operating category. The IASB also decided to add application guidance clarifying that income and expenses from financial assets recognized from providing financing to customers are classified in the operating category. And the IASB decided to confirm the proposed accounting policy choice for companies that provide financing to customers, and that this choice is applied to income and expenses from financing transactions and not to specified income and expenses from other liabilities. So that was the first topic that the board talked about on primary financial statements. The second topic moves into disaggregation, and specifically it relates to operating expenses by nature. In July, the IASB decided to require companies to disclose the amounts of depreciation, amortization, and employee benefits included in each line item in the statement of profit or loss, and to explore a general approach that would require an entity to disclose the amounts included in each line item in the statement of profit or loss for all operating expenses disclosed in the notes. And then finally, the third topic that the IASB discussed was related to unusual income and expenses, and questions that it will need to address to proceed with the definition of unusual income and expenses. The IASB did not make any decisions, but it continued to discuss questions that it will need to answer to provide a definition of unusual income and expenses. In this area, as we've talked about in previous podcasts, continues to be a challenging topic to nail down so that we capture in this definition what is useful to investors without capturing too much. So there's also a question that the board discussed about whether the IASB should even continue investing time trying to figure out how to define unusual income and expenses when it may not be as significant a feature in this project as some of the other proposals.
So quite thorny, really. And we have invested some time, but I think we have had a very good discussion. So let's hope that we can continue in that vein. Shall I proceed with rate regulated activities, Nili?
Yes, please do.
Okay. So the IASB continued to look at the proposals in the exposure draft for the rate regulated activities project. This month, we looked at two topics. First, at components of total allowed compensation, that is, whether the proposed components of total allowed compensation appropriately reflect the economics of incentive-based schemes. The IASB decided the application guidance should focus on helping companies identify differences in timing instead of specifying the components of total allowed compensation. And we also decided that the application guidance would do so by focusing on the most common differences in timing that could arise from various types of regulatory schemes. The second topic concerns regulatory returns on an asset not yet available for use. In fact, the IASB had a very long discussion around this issue. It redeliberated its proposals that these regulatory returns should be reflected during the operation of the asset and decided that when an entity has enforceable rights for regulatory returns on an asset not yet available for use, those returns should form part of the total allowed compensation for goods and services supplied during the construction of that asset. That is, the returns would be reflected in profit or loss during the construction period. And secondly, we decided to provide guidance on how entities would assess whether their rights to these regulatory returns are enforceable.
Thank you, Andreas. That's quite a change from the exposure draft, and I think one that really shows that stakeholders made some very good arguments for the board to consider and take a different approach with its original proposal.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So moving on to another oldie but goodie, goodwill and impairment. Many of our listeners might recall that in April this year, the IASB met to discuss the possible ways forward for improving disclosure requirements about business combinations, specifically to help investors understand the performance of a business combination and to hold management to account. This is also a tricky area, and it requires balancing the provision of useful information to investors while recognizing concerns about commercial sensitivity of disclosures, litigation risk, auditability of disclosures, and the availability of information after integration of the acquired business. This month, the IASB looked at further evidence relating to disclosures about business combinations, including what information is of greatest priority to users, how useful existing disclosures are for investors and how they might be improved, how well disclosure exemptions in other IFRS accounting standards and in jurisdictional regulations work in practice, and research to help identify an appropriate subset of business combinations the IASB's preliminary views on disclosures would apply to. The IASB also received a summary of feedback and advice about how to balance investor information needs with disclosure concerns. Specifically, the IASB received feedback from CMAC and GPF members on how the IASB may proceed with the project, and from ASAF members on how to identify a subset of business combinations and design an exemption that would allow companies to be exempted from disclosing specific items of information in particular circumstances if the IASB decided to do so. Now, the next meeting will be the critical one. In September, our plan of staff is to ask the IASB to make a tentative decision on whether to proceed with its preliminary views on improving disclosure requirements for business combinations. So stay tuned for that.
Our last topic regarding the big projects refers to the Disclosure Initiative, our project on the Targeted Standards Level Review of Disclosures, or TSLR in short. As a reminder, the IASB's project on Targeted Standards Level Review of Disclosure set out to address what we've been calling the disclosure problem, being not enough relevant information, too much irrelevant information, and ineffective communication. To do this, the IASB published an exposure draft in which we applied two approaches. Firstly, we proposed new guidance to use when the IASB develops and drafts disclosure requirements and IFRS standards. And then we tested those drafting proposals on IFRS 13 and IAS 19 by proposing to replace their disclosure requirements with a new set of disclosure requirements developed by applying the drafting proposals. At this meeting, the IASB explored possible ways of taking forward the TSLR project in light of the feedback on its exposure draft. Although decisions were made at this meeting, IASB members provided comments on possible next steps. Given the feedback that we heard on the exposure draft, most IASB members did not support finalizing the approach to drafting disclosure requirements proposed in the exposure draft. Instead, we favored exploring a middle ground approach that would seek to combine disclosure objectives with required items of information. Furthermore, some of our colleagues expressed reservations about proceeding with the proposed requirements to IFRS 13 and IAS 19, I should say, the amendments rather than the requirements. The IASB will decide the next steps for this project at a future meeting.
Thanks, Andreas. So that covers the updates on our big research and standard setting projects. Let's move on to our work on maintenance and consistent application, starting with our narrow scope project on supplier finance arrangements. Andreas, can I turn that over to you?
Yeah, sure. The IASB heard a summary of the feedback received to its exposure draft. The highlights from that feedback include the following points. A high degree of investor interest in and support for the project, which is good. Most respondents of all types said there is a need to improve disclosures about supplier finance arrangements, so we're probably right. Many respondents supported aspects of the proposal while also suggesting reduced, alternative, or additional disclosures. So we have to balance that. A few respondents disagreed, expressing concern over disclosure overload. They question whether adding specific disclosure requirements is an efficient way of addressing investor information needs for particular arrangements. But overall, a positive response from our stakeholders about this project.
Thanks. And so the next step for the board will be to start redeliberating the proposals and moving on to possible final amendments. In terms of other consistent application and maintenance projects, we have a couple other updates. The first is that the IASB concluded its deliberations on amendments to IS1 and the classification of liabilities with covenants as current or non-current. Most importantly, the IASB decided on an effective date for these amendments of 1 January 2024. It also decided to defer the effective date of amendments that were made to IAS-1 back in 2020 on the same topic to the same date. So the 2020 amendments would also be effective on 1 January 2024. You might recall that previously those 2020 amendments were effective as of 1 January 2023. Now, amendments to IAS-1 are expected to be issued in the fourth quarter of this year. And then finally, the IASB finalized agenda decisions from the Interpretations Committee on three topics. The first is negative low emission vehicle credits and the question of whether particular measures to encourage reductions in vehicle carbon emissions give rise to liabilities. The second agenda decision is on classification of public shares by special purpose acquisition companies as financial liabilities or equity. And then the third agenda decision is on the transfer of insurance coverage under a group of annuity contracts. And then finally, as I promised, we wanted to flag the inaugural meeting of our sister board, the ISSB. I had the opportunity to attend part of their meeting in which they discussed their consultation on agenda priorities. The ISSB will be seeking feedback from stakeholders soon on its priorities for the next 2 years. And of course, there are opportunities for both the IASB and the ISSB to work together to develop cohesive standards. One possible area, among others, depending on the feedback that the ISSB receives on its consultation, is with the project on management commentary. This project is currently on the IASB's work plan. And in July, the IASB received an update on this project, noting the evolving landscape since the management commentary exposure draft was published in May of 2021, including calls from stakeholders for the IASB to collaborate with the ISSB, and a commitment by the chairs of the IASB and the ISSB to consider similarities and differences between the management commentary exposure draft and the integrated reporting framework. So there's definitely some interesting discussions and developments here, and stay tuned for more. And that concludes our July IASB update. You can catch up on previous episodes of this IASB update and the IFRS Interpretations Committee on our website, as well as our YouTube channel and Spotify. You can also catch up on a podcast by Emmanuel and Ngu, the chair and vice chair of the ISSB, on their July meeting. For the latest developments, make sure to subscribe to our website. And if you like this podcast, please do take some time to rate, review, and subscribe on your preferred podcast player. And remember to tune in again in September. Thank you so much.